Szkoda mi, nie szkoda mi, że jestem taki słaby, że jestem taki słaby. Coraz słabszy jestem z oddechem każdym. Jestem z oddechem
This is a short story of two places, each remarkably distinct from the other. On one hand, Sokołowsko, a village nestled in the forested landscape of southwestern Poland, surrounded by pristine nature, serves as a refuge for Polish city dwellers seeking an escape from the noisy capital. On the other hand, we have Floating University, located in Germany's capital, Berlin, a city of culture par excellence. Despite their apparent differences on the nature-culture divide, Sokołowsko representing the natural and Floating representing the cultural, both are hybrids of modernity. A closer examination of Sokołowsko reveals a landscape that is not entirely natural. The village's infrastructure, with its geo-engineered water streams and paths designed to complement Hermann Bremer's sanatorium for tuberculosis treatment, exemplifies a nature-culture hybrid. The sanatorium's hydrotherapy method necessitated a specific spatial organization to create the desired climate, demonstrating that Sokołowsko is a culturally tamed nature, or even better, a place where both elements feed one another. These two elements flow together through the village.
We know that Bremer was really careful about the streams because he was treating differently the streams and the Woda Stokowa, which is like this surfacing water. And he was putting some of the buildings above the streams. He was using the water from the streams to make like a proto air conditioning. Mm-hmm. So in the main building, there is a leftover of the system that they were using the water to evaporate in the room. So according to the patient, there was a different moisture. And he was accounting, as I was explaining to some, even the heat of the body in the equation. So for example, he was not heating up the common rooms, because he knew that the crowd is heating up the spaces, which is very bad for the spread of the disease. Of the disease. So, for example, he had like cold rooms, and this is why the main building is as well above the stream. We love to read how the concept of nature came and from where, and mm-hmm. how it happened that Europeans seeing each other outside of it. Because that's the biggest problem, and this is why we're trying to propose some experiences of spaces to reconnect again. Yeah. Because we are part of it, yeah. And architecture is part of the nature, and we still have to explain to everybody that it's not a shelter from nature, it's part of it. And it's really for our friends architects, it's really the concept, challenging concept. They're still thinking about the architectural envelopes as something which has to protect us, as something which has to be like sealed. And this is the only way to survive and think about the future, how to make the more and more like strong envelopes. And instead, you know, there are people who saying like unplug, open up, like be in tune, synchronize, and that will be much better for everyone.
Floating University is a similar hybrid. According to its website, and I quote, The site was designed in the early 1930s as a rainwater retention basin to serve the Tempelhof airfield and adjacent avenues, and it was encased in concrete after the Second World War by the US Army. After it stopped serving its original purpose, on its site, a diverse range of animals, plants, and algae have taken root and given birth to unique landscape. A man-made environment reclaimed by nature, where polluted water coexists with the relatively new presence of the university, forming a nature culture, or a third landscape. End of quote.
Floating University is a public water infrastructure, is a rainwater retention pool, so the water that rains on the roofs of Tempelhof, the building, kind of trickle down through Columbia Dam and then enter here and then go into the Landwehr Canal and then they go into the Spree and then they go into the North Sea somehow. And by working here and with the work of an association that is more than 60 members, so I'm here representing also many other bodies and voices, we've been thinking a lot about urban feral wetlands. Yeah, so watery ecologies in cities, nature cultures, things that are one thing but are also many other things. And one of the most important thing for us by opening this space, which was just a rainwater management system that was closed off to the public, that it was only the Realm of experts. For us, opening this site and make it available to the public was an intent also of hybridizing its use and to move away from monofunctional modernist thinking into the layering of meaning, the layering of uses, the layering and the layering and the layering.
The process of modernization, as described by sociologist Bruno Latour, consists of two processes: purification and hybridization. The former produces pure and self-standing identities, clearly differentiating between nature and culture, between human and other than human. However, the latter operates on a different, clandestine plane, unnoticed by the workings of purification, which remains unaware of the production of hybrids. "We have never been modern," Latour wrote. In other words, despite our love for identity and clear distinctions, we have never seized the multiplication of hybrids.
One thing that maybe that's just me. For us, it's important that both of those like ecosystems, landscapes, these places in the world, they're also like multi-layered, very complex, and that although they are very beautiful, we try, you know, also to see and understand how they were manufactured, geoengineered, how they are, in a sense, toxic, and how those relationships between humans and more than humans in those places are much more complicated. Because the way, for example, Sokołowsko is usually narrated, also in Polish, like, literature, and it's kind of became more and more popular in recent years in Poland, is that it's beautiful space for natural retreat, you know, hikes in the mountains, which is true. But if you take the proper route, you see that, oh, actually the mountain is being eaten by the gigantic, you know, mine that is right there that you maybe don't see at the first glance, but it's there and it's completely changing, like, the ecosystem and the microclimate of the place. In Floating, it's probably more obvious that this is like a, you know, but you could also treat it as a natural reserve, this place of calmness and, you know, exiting the hustle and bustle of big city like Berlin. And Sokołowsko kind of plays the same role for people from Warsaw. It's very popular for Warsawians. So we try to see those places for what they actually are. And, you know, water in Floating is kind of toxic. Maybe the microclimate in Sokołowsko and also the practices of healing and sanatorium that were practiced there are not that good for anyone, actually. You know, so we, both of the places to me are like complex in these terms. And then as, you know, as a natural ecosystem, let's say. And also, yeah, we also always think about the influence of human activity on the space. You know, we know that the team at Floating is very caring and they are really conscious about it. In Sokołowsko, for example, it's much more complicated. And although people who come there are very often like, yeah, environmentally, ecologically minded, they try to see it as this like very pure natural experience. And we were also trying to subvert that when we were in Sokołowsko, you know, also making trips to the mine, you know, or going to the places when there is logging going on to like see the complexity and, you know, really also the destruction and the beauty.
These complexities build our world, and Sokołowsko and Floating University are two places that bear clear witness to this fact. Give them a deep listen and you'll hear it too.
The more I listen, the more I learn to listen. Deep listening involves going below the surface of what is heard, expanding to the whole field of sound while finding focus. This is the way to connect with the acoustic environment, all that inhabits it and all that there is. The key to multi-level existence is deep listening. Listening is as many ways as possible to everything that can possibly be heard, all of the time. Deep listening is exploring the relationships among any and all sounds, whether natural or technological, intended or unintended, real, remembered or imaginary. Thought is included. Deep listening includes all sounds, expanding the boundaries of perception. In this concept, is language and the nature of its sound, as well as natural sound and technological sound. Deep listening also includes the environmental and atmospheric context of sound. Deep listening is listening in every way possible to everything it's possible to hear, no matter what you are doing. Such intense listening includes the sounds of daily life, of nature, or one's own thoughts, as well as musical sounds. Deep listening represents a heightened state of awareness and connects to all that there is.
We just do what we usually do. We keep breathing.
And with your next exhale,
you're traveling back in time. Back at a time when Europe was covered by thick ice sheets around 12,000 years ago. So once you got to the ice, I invite you to stay with it for a moment. Feel the temperature.
Get a feeling of the thickness of the ice that weighs around 3,000 meters thick on top of the surface.
And of course it's not laying still, it's moving back and forth. The ice moves, it moves rocks and gravel. You can imagine the glacier grinding. And now the water is coming.
I tried to remember all the different sounds I heard. And while trying that, I realized that it's much easier when you have a name for the sound or for the being you're listening to, like especially with the birds. Whenever I could identify a certain bird sound, I was like, oh, that's a blackbird or that's a sparrow. Then it was easier for me to later remember I had heard of like bird or sparrow, and that made me wonder about something I thought before, that it's maybe easier to respect something or even recognize something or worship something when you have a name for it. And I wondered how I could relate, like for example, to the different sounds of the wind if I had names for them, not just for the birds.
Hybridization can also be observed in the intentions and actions of a group of individuals, duck rabbits they call themselves, who follow the Contexte Post-Artistic Congress. I wanted to know a bit more about this meeting, which is more than just a mere congress or assembly.
Post-Artistic Congress was supposed to be this strange tool to bring people together to investigate the site of Sokołowsko over the course of 3 years. So we thought that instead of organizing a festival which brings artists to present their work in the context, we will blur the boundaries between the public and these who are presenting, and enable participants, delegates of the Congress, to immerse in these practices and reach these practices, and also see how they work in this specific context of Sokołowsko. Post-Artistic Congress is some sort of a tool that can be adapted to different situations, that it's at the same time can be localized, but also it is a sensitive tool. So it will work differently in different places, but these tools has some sub-tools which enable us to be sensitive, to be observant to this, to the localities where it emerges.
These duck rabbits are post-artistic creatures, post-artists, not artists, imaginative activists, excellent cooks, unartists, others, river sisters, avid ramblers, maverick gardeners, fossil situationists, eco-feminist performers, militant conceptualists, amateur navigators, and stray academics. These eclectic assemblage is described as a mixed breed, hybrid species, and motley crew by Kuba Schroeder in his publication Duck Rabbits Unveiled. I wanted to know a bit more about these duck rabbits and their practices.
So my position is quite ambiguous because I'm like working in a public museum, so I'm like a art worker, you know, like situated in a quite conventional context, you know, like the way of like producing and exhibiting. But I've been also like doing many things which are not leading to like really producing an artwork. So I'm working, I hardly do exhibitions, you know, like so for many years. And I'm like a sociologist by education, so I'm coming from social sciences. And for me, like, you know, convening things rather than curating and having like an assembly, a congress, even like a symposium or like something like even more academic, it's a very natural environment. So I think they're like two movements, so to speak, you know, like two directions, you know, like on one hand, those, as we call them, like post-artistic phenomena or like movements or like groups are really kind of infiltrating public institutions and treating it as one of those like possible environments, one of the possible habitats, and they're like feeding on the resources of the public institutions, using it as a kind of platform to disseminate their like ideas without like exhibiting anything, you know, without like really having like a show or you know, an artwork on a pedestal. On the other hand, the museums, like, I think they are quite advanced. You know, there are many advanced museums who are like trying to move from the building somewhere else even staying in the building, you know, like symbolically moving from this like edifice, from the structure. So there are like two movements, but at the same time it creates like the third kind of situation, which we call like a rabbit duck situation, you know. So it's like both, you know. So there are like hundreds of practitioners who are like might be labeled as artists, but they don't have to. Maybe they don't care. They might use the kind of you know, their competences in a more like an artistic sphere, but they also like, they can support social movements, they can participate in like demonstrations, occupations, they can be social workers, gardeners, and so on. And this is quite a very rich habitat, I would say, you know. So people who graduated from fine arts academies, they are very often ending up as you know, as non-artists. But my belief is that you never stop being artists, even if you don't produce artworks, you don't exhibit this kind of imagination, this like conceptual way of approaching things, problems, issues. It's materializing somewhere else, and this is what my curatorial practice is mainly about, you know, like kind of like following those energies. Yeah.
Here at Floating, we discovered that these ideas that for us are kind of obvious, because this is what we do, the post-artistic practices, were kind of refreshing. Not because they are new, because there's, as Kuba mentioned in his lecture, a lot of collectives or groups that are practicing in this collective, unhierarchical and like unartistic way, under different names. But there are some local specificities that are interesting, and even if you practice post art in another country and you get this perspective how we do it, then all of a sudden it gets different. So it's hard to say what's going to be the future, but I personally think that maybe, yes, in Poland we are bringing the wood to the forest, but maybe there are other places that need that wood.
The question of last year's Contexte Post-Artistic Congress was how to responsibly self-organize in times of crisis, and softness was one of the answers. What is this softness we like to speak about concerning the Post-Artistic Congress? To quote Teresa Dillon's article, Methodologies of Softness, if we were to ask what methodologies of softness are, a core underlying element would be the notion of attentive tending. It is difficult to precisely pin down how this actually manifests, but it is a mix of intentional acts of movement and maneuver that purposefully aim to reverse, alleviate, and soften normative framings while also scaffolding and supporting transitions of change. This begs the question, what change are we seeking or speaking to? End of quote.
This team of Contexte is like, we are working a lot beyond that. So we have like those different like tentacles and nets and like connections with different people. And actually we started working together to like support each other in like around 2015, when politically situation in Poland was really bad, very dark. There was a lot of tensions and we felt really lost. We just wanted to like come together and like be together. So I would say this softness is in this way of like doing things together, not to like make a project, not to like, you know, like show something, to do a festival, to do, I don't know, a performance, but just to create those spaces of like being together and learning from each other and supporting each other. So the first Contexte was really in Sokołowsko in Poland. It was this space where we came to like pre-made structure. There was, you know, some tradition built on this Kontekste festival, and it was like the first try to change something in the way that we are doing things there. And for me, it was, I would say, the hardest part of Kontekste, because there was a lot of those tensions with the like pre-made structure there. So we were really tired after this first edition. Like, there was a lot of people coming just to experience something. They didn't want to participate in the structure. They didn't want to like to help to be there. They just wanted to like see something and just, you know, go and have their wine. So there was a lot, like a burden of workload on this team. So we wanted to learn and build on this experience. And next time that we came up with the soft seminar, it was like built on this. We really wanted to rebuild this structure, and not to build a festival, but build this like space where we are doing things together, but the structure there is like visible for everyone. Everyone like participates in building this from, you know, like both sides, and then like experiencing something. There was our amazing like cooking artist chef Paula Sutryk, who told us like while cooking that eating together is as important as cooking together and cleaning together. Yeah, so I would say this softness is in that, you know, like care for everything, for the process, for the peoples, and like being mindful about all these parts of this.
Mosses are prolific under the moist, shaded canopy of evergreens, often creating a dense carpet of green. But in deciduous forests, autumn makes the forest floor virtually uninhabitable by mosses, smothering them under a dark, wet blanket of falling leaves. Mosses find a refuge from the drifting leaves on logs and stumps, which rise above the forest floor like butters above the plain. Mosses succeed by inhabiting places that trees cannot. Hard, impermeable substrates, such as rocks and cliff faces and bark of trees. But with elegant adaptations, mosses don't suffer from this restriction. Rather, they are the undisputed masters of their chosen environment.
Aren't duck rabbits akin to mosses? Mossy and soft duck rabbits thrive on strange, damp surfaces. The surfaces of rocks, the bark of trees, the surface of a log. These are the surfaces we often deem uninhabitable and undesirable, remnants of ruins. Yet, these soggy, post-artistic creatures, the very people with whom I had the pleasure of spending truly memorable days, first in Sokołowsko and later in Berlin, possess a unique sensitivity. They are adept at seeking out, perceiving, and responding to the subtle and often overlooked phenomena that emerge in the ruins of capitalism. Their attunement to these emergent forms, much like the mosses that strive on the surfaces we typically consider uninhabitable, allows them to find beauty and possibility in the cracks of a crumbling system. They demonstrate an extraordinary capacity to engage with and nurture the nascent, transformative elements that arise amidst decay, fostering new forms of life and creativity in spaces where others see only ruin.
Enough about human rights. What about hog rights? What about frog rights? What about kite rights? What about mate rights? What about bee rights? What about rent rights?